very, very pleased. We have two amazingly talented people who made this incredible film. I'd first like to invite the director, who is known for such comedies as Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers and the Austin Powers trilogy. And then it's a natural switch to go from that to presidential politics, Recount and Game Change. And he did an incredible job on this film. Please welcome Jay Roach. And I think most of you, many of you remember that 2 years ago we did an exhibition here called From Mr. Chips to Scarface about the creation of Walter White. And this is, I think, the first time we've had an actor here where we previously had his underwear on exhibit. And he's, I don't need to tell you, he's one of the most amazing actors working on stage and screen and on stage. Please welcome Bryan Cranston.
Thank you.
I had mentioned that the underwear that was on exhibit here was auctioned off for $10,000.
I want that back, by the way.
Was sold.
I've been going commando ever since.
Okay. It was sold for $10,000. So well, we were talking.
No,
about,
I don't want it back. I don't want.
Okay.
It back.
Okay. But we were talking about maybe doing an auction tonight. So. I do want to say that it was one of the interesting things about this film was the involvement of the Trumbo family. And I believe we have, Molly Gingras. Is she here?
Trumbo's daughter, Molly, is here, yeah.
This Dalton is Trumbo's Dalton Trumbo's...
This is, yeah. I'm sorry, Dalton Trumbo's granddaughter. Was this the first time you saw the film?
No,
okay, great. Must be weird. See how your grandpa treated
Molly's mom and also Molly's aunt, Mitzi, her mom, and Nikki were involved with us from pretty early on and had a huge amount to do with how the film worked out. Yeah. And actually, the additional dialogue book that I read that sort of inspired me, which were all the compilation of letters that Trumbo wrote, Molly turned it into an ebook, so that was that really helped me. So I'm really grateful to the whole Trumbo family.
Great. So how do you think they did?
Oh my god. I mean, it's surreal. It's hard to
I'm sure.
Hard to say, but there's a lot to like. So.
What was it like for I guess for both of you, but working, you know, Dalton Trumbo was well documented. So what was it like? Creating a character who existed in real life like this. I mean, it was obviously a larger-than-life personality.
I think there's a distinction there, is that I don't know if you really create the character. The character was created already, and all I try to do with non-fictional characters is to get close to them, to get the essence of them, the sensibility of the man, to allow him to come inside me, to live there, warts and all, and allow him to not look his best at times or be naked at times or whatever the case may be, and to truly allow him to live and breathe. And once that happens for an actor and it gets inside, then all the direction and commentary and review of the scripts and the other source material that you take in now is being filtered through your own. Mm-hmm. And you craft your own Dalton Trumbo and present it and, you know, with honor and respect, and hopefully it you know, there's a sense of honesty to it.
Could you talk, I do want to ask both of you about just what drew you to this material. So you were there first, I guess, so could you talk about that? Like why did you do this film?
I couldn't believe that there was so much about it I didn't know. Mm. I knew some about it. I actually had a directing teacher at USC, Edward Dimitrik, who was one of the Hollywood Ten. Mm. He was the only one who wasn't a writer and the only one who, after he came out of prison, actually named names to rehabilitate himself. one of the heartbreaking aspects of this story is watching someone like Edward G. Robinson, who couldn't hide behind pseudonyms and fronts, trying to just figure out, well, does that mean I'm done? Or if I just do a little, if I just name a few names? And people were put into that horrible position. The writers actually had it a little easier. They still, obviously, many of them lost work and lost their careers, and not everybody figured out a way to keep working the way Trumbo did. But the directors couldn't do that. So he actually did come out and had to make that dilemma. So part of what drew me to the story was, you know, the kind of question of what would you do? What would we do? Any of us do in that situation? We all like to think we would make the Trumbo choice, as many people did. But in some cases, it meant the end of your career. It might be the end of any success you had. You might lose your home, your family, and some of these people were put in the just worst possible situation. So the sort of souls at stake really drew me to the story, and then just the man, his ability to write, and these letters from jail were so poignant and also funny and insulting to his enemies. Like, he was a brilliant, brilliant, really amazing writer. So that's what made me want to do it.
Yeah.
It's that too. I always look for story first. Is the story compelling? Did it resonate with me? Did I feel for these characters? And then did this script support that great story? And John McNamara drafted a beautiful script and hit A's across the board there. Then I look to the character and I not so much of is he big and juicy and
yeah.
Which he was, but mostly how important is this character to the story? Does the character impede the story? Is the center of the story? Is it a catalyst to the story? And that was everything. And Dalton Trumbo's character itself was, as you saw, larger than life. He was that flamboyant, interesting, you know, with birds and and the cigarette holder, and his daughters told us he was the kind of guy, and those of us old enough have seen him, guys who light cigarettes from the cigarette that's going out, boom, and into the cigarette holder, which was an affectation of sorts, and he's trying to understand what that was about. And you know, they talk about how crazy he was when he wrote in the bathtub. Well, actually, I found out that there was some practical application to that. He was told, I mean, he had chronic back problems from hunching over and hunting pecking as he did. Hmm. And he didn't take care of himself. He didn't sleep well. He drank too much. He didn't eat well. And of course, you're going to mess yourself up. So he was advised to take hot Epsom salt baths for like an hour and a half, 2 hours a day. And he couldn't justify spending that much time every day in a bathtub.
Right.
So, but if I take my workstation and make it a desk, now he can. So he was trying to kill two birds with one stone.
I mean, this is a man who only slept 4 hours a night. He was not only always writing his own scripts during the black market screenplay years, he was rewriting a ton of other people's scripts because he had vouched for them. So
yeah.
He turned, that's one of the things that always moved me about the story too, is it is writing as a superpower. He actually writes his way out of jail in a way, and writes his way out of figurative jail too, by exposing the lunacy of this freaking system that's supposed to keep everybody from working. But he wins two Academy Awards. These other guys are all writing really interesting movies, and the studios finally just said, "What are we doing? We're not accomplishing anything, and we are just, you know, torturing these guys." And they dropped it when his name appears on Spartacus, and you know, you just see Helen's Hedda Hopper's just dissolving like the Wicked Witch, because the spell is broken.
Yeah,
and it's all because of the writing, really, with a lot of help from people like Kirk Douglas and Preminger and Frank King, who's maybe my second favorite character in the whole story, is Frank King when he comes at the head of the union, Roy Brewer, with the baseball bat.
Is there anything either of you can say about like the process of showing writing? I always think that's a hard thing to dramatize. Like, first of all, the actor, you have to believe that the actor is capable of writing, and this is a brilliant, brilliant writer. And then you're showing a process that doesn't seem that dramatic, you know, staring at a piece of paper.
No, actually, it was difficult to go from a full finger keyboard, which I type on, to hunt and pecking. It really messed with me. And and a couple times I started to write like this. I go, no, I have to do this. And it was an adjustment. I felt awkward doing it, and I was a little insecure about that. But you're right. Seeing you know the cinema dynamic of someone writing is not keen, but I think you did a terrific job.
I'll tell you what hooked me on the possibility that could get more interesting is that I do know writers who mutter to themselves and kind of say the lines and act the lines, and if you see them from the back at a restaurant or something, I once stumbled upon a friend. I said, "Oh my God, are you okay? It looked like you're having a seizure." So he goes, "No, I was just acting out the scene."
Yeah,
and I think. Trumbo, if you like the daughter does, overhears him muttering in the bathtub and then comes in, and then later when he's alone, he's still muttering to himself and he's scotch taping. And I feel like if you could just get the sense of the writer tapping into all of the aspects of himself, even the dysfunctional ones, the demons, you know, and I felt like Trumbo had access to those. He could write great villains and great people with terrible dysfunctions. And I think, I don't know, I just thought that might be the way to do it, is to show it, sort of him channeling these people like a channeler, you know. That was the hope.
Just imagine to those who are not writers to enter into that profession where you take an amount of people like this and half of you in a film, and the writer is responsible for creating not only your character and the specificity of your characters and the relationship to each other and what you have to say. And it's like, of course they're going to be schizophrenic. There's going to be some troubled troubled men and women who writers are tortured, you know, by and large. And even the writers out there, I think, will go, that's pretty true. it's an arduous undertaking. It's great and fulfilling, but it's painful at times.
You describe Trumbo as larger than life, and this question of how you found like the tone of the performance and how big the performance was, because it's very theatrical, and I think, you know, film is very intimate medium. And I'm just wondering maybe how you work together on that, because I think there might be a tendency to want to hold back. And it's there's something about the person, Trumbo, that makes him grand and big. And I'm just wondering how you work with that on the set, you know, managing that.
Well, it was a definitive concern of mine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Going in, I was nervous because he is a big, flamboyant, theatrical man. But the real man and the cinematic man, does that matter in making that transition from the real man to the person that audiences are going to see? The only important thing really is, are they going to buy it? If you sense that my performance was sublime and right in line with that kind of sensibility, that's very much appreciative. If you thought it was too big at times, I blame Jay. For not honing me in. I mean, I don't know why. Why would you let that happen?
We had so many talks about it too, and part of it was just being authentic to the guy. He performed ideas. He wasn't an actor, although he has a great part in Papillon as the prison warden.
Last time you saw Papillon.
Yeah, it's a really interesting
truly,
film.
Papillon,
by the way.
Check it out. It's
a really interesting film. Dustin Hoffman has a brilliant performance. Paul Newman. Steve McQueen, and then
very
Trumbo.
Much about, you know, the being truthful and honorable, and
you forget how many films like that he wrote. But he was someone who just was an old school orator. He would stand on a box at a strike, you know. He spoke at the Shrine Theater when the MPA, the Motion Picture Alliance for Preservation of American Ideals, when they started growing in prominence, there was a group formed of all the unions in town, and they met the Shrine Auditorium, I think, holds like 5,000 or 6,000 people, where they used to have the Oscars, and he spoke, you know, as one of the keynote address. I mean, he would speak in public. He was just a writer, but he was always performing his arguments, and very much like that's why we put that interview at the end. You can see how every word matters, and he has this melody in his speech. And so we just thought, you know, we should try to be authentic to that. It's odd and idiosyncratic, but it was what he liked. He had something to say, and he said it. That's what I loved about him.
You know, one of the things I love about this film is that it is so rich in the period detail. I mean, you just did such a great job capturing the specificity of that time period, yet at the same time, it feels so increasingly relevant. Like, I wish it wasn't so relevant, if you know what I mean. It's the way that people use fear, you know, politicians use fear, and the you know, all the issues in the film feel so timely.
I think it's worth mentioning, David, we were talking in the green room and you brought up President Bush Sr. And how he came out today talking about the hawkishness of Rumsfeld and Cheney, and how that drove an agenda and didn't serve his son, you know. And so we see examples of those things, and that's not just from one party. It's, you know, there's a real power to fear-mongering. And it's to gain political power or financial riches. So I mean that
And how about you're thinking about this, because you've been making films about contemporary politics.
I'm always interested in how ideas are marketed, if you will, people try to make them contagious and make them stick, you know. And one of the most useful propagandist tools, of course, in all of history is fear. If you can remind people how afraid they are of a real threat, like totalitarian communism was then or terrorism is now, and somehow make an associative leap to things that aren't really that threatening, but you can make them seem they are by putting new labels on them, by, you know, in that case, calling anyone who is progressive a communist, or today it's calling them a socialist or sometimes communist. That's still an old chestnut for every propagandist to pull out. So it seems as much about today as I think there aren't isn't anyone quite as powerful as Hedda Hopper was by herself, along with maybe Luella Parsons or Walter Winchell or something. But there are lots of people in the media business making a ton of money marketing fear and marketing, you know, sort of outrage and victimization. And that seems like that's, you know, she's kind of recognizable in a few characters I could name today. So
one of the things that's so interesting about this film is, like, Hollywood over the years has policed itself in order to keep the government away. You know, there was the production code and the blacklist. And so the way that people in the industry had to turn against colleagues. You're showing this film now, you're going around to different guilds, you know, the Screen Actors Guild and all these guilds. And I'm just wondering what you're hearing from people who, you're probably talking to people who were there at the time. Like, what is that like?
Well, we had this very moving lunch a few days ago here. And, you know, we're staying at the Waldorf Astoria. And the Waldorf agreement was the memo that was put out as the blacklist. All the studio heads met there and then put out the statement they would henceforth terminate anyone who was part of the Hollywood 10 or anybody who wouldn't swear loyalty to their sense of what Americanism was. And so, you know, I forgot what was your question? I can say it one more time.
Well, just about the reaction of people who might have lived through this themselves.
We had this incredible lunch with where Lee Grant stood up and reminded us that she was blacklisted from age 24 to 36, and all she was blacklisted for, she wasn't a communist. Mm-hmm. She gave a eulogy at an actor's funeral. Mm. I think Bromford was his name, and he died of a heart attack, and many people he had been blacklisted, and many people thought the blacklist in a way caused the stress that killed him. So she alluded to that possibility that he died of a broken heart from caused by the blacklist, and just for that she was instantly put on the list and appears in Red Channels, a publication where anyone who was even vaguely suspicious would put, or appeared in Hedda Hopper's column. That was another way you could just get. And then we met with this woman who worked at the Paramount casting office, one of the studios. I'm not actually sure it was Paramount, so that could be wrong. But she worked at a casting office during the Blacklist, and she said by 1956 it was so mundane, so everyday. Her job was to make lists that would be of actors that would be right for any particular part, but she'd have to walk it down the hall, take it to clearances, and she'd get it back the next day, and at least, you know, a quarter of them would be scratched off. And these were people she knew were great and perfect for the part, and they were just, they would disappear. And once they disappeared as an actor, you would never come back, you know, for until the Blacklist was over. Sometimes, in her case, 14 or 15 years. It was astonishing.
Yeah. I think, in the midst of all the research, not only on Dalton Trumbo, but the Times and the Troubles. The one thing that I was surprised to learn and greatly dismayed, is that you mentioned the unions. Every union turned against these members. Mm. The Writers Guild, the Directors Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, the Motion Picture Academy turned against them.
Yeah, you couldn't be nominated if you were.
So the one job that a Blacklist union is supposed to do, protect its members, they failed on their number one job. Yeah. And it's a shame. But I think it just shows you the gravity and the level of fear that permeated not just Hollywood, but in the United States at the time. And I'm told, and I think this is pretty accurate, we did some research, about 65% of the population of America during that time believed that the Red Menace was a real thing and that there were cells planted throughout and a lot. Okay, you're telling me they're in the entertainment, but okay, let's get them out.
Idea,
it was a popular idea. So it wasn't difficult for the fearmongers to twist it, you know, just keep mentioning it. And what happens when that occurs is that it doesn't matter if it's the truth or not. What becomes important is the perception of what the truth is.
And some of it was true. There were people trying to steal secrets. There were cells of people trying to figure out ways to undo certain aspects of our culture. But in Hollywood, they weren't doing it, as he said, they didn't steal it off a fucking camera truck, you know, but they also didn't do it through Roman Holiday or, a Boy and His Bull, which is the original title of The Brave One. That was what they were being accused of, and yet they never would name a film. They never banned a film. They just went after these guys who, by the way, had all been active in trying to unionize, unions that weren't studio friendly. So they mostly were targeted for their union efforts. But if they had named a particular film, they would have had to sort of reveal that the studio heads approved those films, every single one of them. So you'd have to say, well, the writers were puppeteering the studio heads, and the studio heads had no power. So they never got that far, and so the logical extension was never gotten. And the committee disbanded with no proof of ever having found anybody ever guilty of trying to actually subvert America through films. So it was a bust. It was like a lot of congressional committees, even today, that waste a ton of money and have nothing to show for them at the end, just for political points for the people on the panel.
I'm sure the next Benghazi hearings we'll find out. We're going to learn a lot from that one. I have two questions about production, and then we'll open it up for audience questions. One is just about, this is a very serious film, but it's really funny, too. I mean, if you heard the audience tonight, there was a lot of laughter. How did you think about the incorporation? Certainly you're known for comedy, but... Yeah. How did you think about balancing the tone?
Well, again,
of this film?
I just make all the decisions from what's authentic to these people. Dalton Trumbo was one of the funniest men I've encountered. He was also one of the most zealous, serious, militant, abrasive. You know, but all you have to do is read this great book of letters that Molly helped turn into an ebook recently. There are letters to enemies from jail. There's beautiful letters to his wife and kids, but there are some to his enemies where one producer was trying to kind of have it both ways, saying, I support you guys, but why don't you just talk? Why don't you just cooperate? And he wrote back and called him a political hermaphrodite. And there's another great letter that to his to his son, and this is, these aren't even related to what was going on at the time. He used humor to cope with. He used it to embarrass, you know, with sarcastic quips, even in the HUAC hearing you could hear. But he'd also just use humor to cheer people up. And he wrote his son in college and said, I'm sending you two books. One's about gambling. You're going to win a ton of money. Don't tell anybody I sent it to you. The other one is about sex. I'm sending you a sex education book because I experienced so much guilt and anxiety about sex, particularly about masturbation. And there's a great chapter about masturbation. It's to help you not feel so guilty about it. Signed, signed, the masturbator's masturbator, your father, Dalton Trumbo.
Wow. I was like,
that's a man who has a heart and a soul and is also earthy and cool and willing to... It's so long. You wouldn't believe how much you could find to say on this topic, but he could, and it was.
I don't know if you mentioned that additional dialogue.
Additional dialogue is the title, right, of the of the compilation of the of the letters.
And there's also a documentary by the same name that was created by Chris Trumbo.
Chris Trumbo and the director of the play, whose name I forgot about, Peter Askin,
Peter Askin,
is it? And there's a really great new biography of Trumbo by Chris Trumbo and also Larry Sepler. And it kind of extracts from the book we used, the Bruce Cook book, but it's updates and it's very, very dense and beautiful. You want to know all the details of this story. There's so many other layers that we couldn't get to.
Yeah.
The e-book is not out yet, but soon.
Okay,
thanks,
you heard that. Coming soon. So I want to ask a little bit about the way that you work. I was reading... I forget somebody who was worked on the film who was interviewed and was talking about like how there's a bit of Dalton Trumbo in you, and the quote was something like, "Oh, yeah, Brian, he can be very cantankerous and obsessive," and I don't really usually. It wasn't Jay. But do you?
I think I fired him.
Oh, good.
Well, you know, Michael Lunden said that. I heard he said I'm cantankerous, and I mean, it's creating a. No, it's giving me a little cred, a little tough guy cred. I like that.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm getting a fight with.
But I do want to ask about like how you work. And one detail I was curious about was this film. There's a lot of costume changes in this film. I think I read that you had like 60 different costumes. I mean, they cover such a big time period. I'm just wondering like how that works in the creation of a character. You know, the detail of the costume. How does that put you into character?
Well, it does help. This covered 24 years, is that? Am I recalling that correctly?
47 to 70.
Yeah. You know, actors use all kinds of talismans and things that help them connect to a character. And, you know, getting into makeup and putting on the mustaches every morning, depending on what year was, helps you mark those times a little bit. And you carefully go over the script and you say, okay, here's a transition from this period into this period into this four or five different looks, different amount of gray in the hair and whatnot. And then we decided to go without the mustache in the jail, which we saw the mugshots of Dalton, and he didn't have a mustache at the time. So it helps to establish the change in life. You know, anybody who puts on a tuxedo will stand and sit differently than if they were in jeans and a t-shirt. It does change the way you feel, and if you're coiffed, and if, you know, I mean, so there's a certain amount of that helps as well. But it's just, you know, it's just about getting to the core of the person, and what his focus is and what his agenda is, and being clear on the relationships of the people. Yeah.
Okay, I'll ask one more thing. This is probably a question that you get asked a lot, so I'm sorry. But after doing Walter White, which is one of the most, you know, monumental and greatest characters ever like created on screen, I mean, it's just an amazing character. You have to then follow that, and you've done so far. You did. This incredible performance as LBJ in All the Way, which I'm very grateful to hear that you guys are making that into a film.
Yes.
Yeah. For HBO, yeah. next May, it'll be out next May.
And then this. So what was your sort of post Walter White plan?
I did have one. when I knew there was about a year and a half left of Breaking Bad, and that was going to go away, the zeitgeist surrounding that show was becoming unwieldy and uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And so I sort of wanted to just get out of its way and let it become what it's supposed to become and receive how it's supposed to be received by anybody who watches it or doesn't. And it was a character that became somewhat iconic, and it's on T-shirts, it's on coffee mugs.
Well, we were happy because people were coming to look at your underwear here.
Yeah, yeah, it's on underwear, they're selling underwear. So that's not good, that's not a good thing for me, because I don't want to be a personality. That's not, I became an actor when I was 23 years old, and I knew that I was committing my life to that art form. That if it meant I was going to be sharing an apartment with three other guys, and then that's the way my life was going to be. It was all in. And I never talked to, never thought of the idea of giving your Emmy or Tony speech or anything like that. I just like the work. And the more I can get inside a character and get lost in a character, or have the character get lost in me, whichever way to see it, the better I feel. That I would rather not be recognized on the street. I would only appreciate being recognized on stage or in film. Mm-hmm. So, but that's just for me. Other people like the popularity or attention.
Was there anything specific about them, the types of characters that you were looking for, or is it was just
no?
A case
it's
a,
it, it, honestly, it yeah. is. I have a roadmap for myself that I call the CAPS. It was the Cranston Assessment of Projects System. The CAPS system, Cranston Assessment of Projects System.
But this only works for you.
And right? I give points. I give point values
wow.
to the different categories of things. And the first one wow. is story. Mm-hmm. And the second one is text. And then the third one is character. The director is way down the list. So, no. Fourth is director, because I have to feel it first. It has to get me first. And then I want to talk to him to see if he gets the same feeling. Or are we in the same realm? Are we going to go on this journey? And it's long, and we spend hours and hours and hours together. And, you know, he's a sweet, lovely, intelligent man. But if he didn't have a clear vision of where he wanted to go with this, I would just want to be his friend. To be absolutely honest with you. But he does. And what I like about Jay the most is that he is not overbearing. He's not as you could sense by his demeanor, he's not a chest pounder, we're doing it my way and that's it. He doesn't yell. It's a very calm, enjoyable set. It's very creative. He opens it up. I remember once in a table read, we were reading it and I read something and I went, And he called me. I said, what was that? And I didn't really even consciously know I did that. It was, what is what? And I went, you grimaced or something. And I went, I did? Yeah, yeah. So I went back and I went, oh, it's just, no, tell me. It's like, well, you know, this is a thing. So if you can make a suggestion or something bumps you and you can make it a 0.5% better and you collect a bunch of those, you've raised the level of the storytelling significantly. And we had such a good time on Trumbo and on All the Way. What are we doing next, by the way?
Yeah, I'm working on it. I gotta come up with
it. No, it doesn't work that way, but you know, we're hoping to find something else after that.
We have a few actually that we're talking about. I just, the script got so much better, the project got better through that process though in the rehearsal. So I just, you know, I just am open to somebody else beating the idea that I have or that the screenplay has. And if you trust great actors, they'll go deeper each into their characters separately, because you can't do all of the characters as deep as any one person can go. And Michael Stuhlbarg was a great example of that. He was so into the, You talked about one of your displays where it was all, for Orson Welles, was about the nose. He was really wanted to a nose, you know, and we didn't really have a budget and we didn't have a prosthetics guy. But we found a way to give him, you know, to give Eddie a little bit of a nose. And it, and his process, the way he helped us get to the essence of what that battle for his own soul was, Edward G. Robinson's soul was, you know, a lot of that came out in rehearsal. But it was, and it was, you know, Brian's very generous with the other actors too. We're all kicking around ideas, and it really is always best idea wins within the amount of resources that you have and time you have to try to improve.
Okay, let's open it up for some questions. So raise your hand. Start over there.
For Jay, there seems to be a similarity in tone to a lot of the more recent films that you've done, from Recount to kind of moving forward. Mm-hmm. How do you balance that drama and that comedy tone throughout? Mm-hmm. And I think it lends itself to kind of Brian's skill set.
Well, I tend to be, I guess I'm a little, I'm very, I have a lot of concerns about our civilization, and I'm very anxious about how things go, and I can't quite figure out how did that happen. Like when Sarah Palin was chosen, I was so interested, like, how did they decide that? I could see that it actually was kind of a brilliant political move, but who thought about what the stakes would be if it went well and if it went wrong? And in this case, how did this happen? But invariably, I find that to be so serious about those questions without acknowledging that funny, smart people with an awareness of the ironies and the absurdities of the situation and not portray that would be, you know, would just be weird and too self-serious. And I always am looking for those characters that have that awareness. And Recount, Dennis Leary played that guy who was in real life just a total smartass, but just happened to be great with poll numbers, you know. And in Game Change, Woody Harrelson's character was a very tortured guy for having made that decision and then found out that they were there, that she wasn't really quite ready. But he always had a dark, dark, dark wit about it, you know. And in this case, Trumbo's letters really were the key for me. They were so he was so good at using wit to, as I say, sort of outsmart the system and beat the system at its own game. So it may be that I just am always drawn to characters like that that are so humanistic that they function on every level, you know, dark, neurotic despair, you know, smartassiness and abrasiveness and coping with it maybe. But at heart, they love people and they want to amuse people sometimes. Trumbo himself in his own book talked at length about how he would always try to even undercut himself to get a laugh just to expose the lunacy of something. And so anyway, that maybe addresses it, but that's what I'm...
What was the quote you heard today?
Oh, he said something like, God put me in a place to make a fool of myself, but nobody expected me to so gloriously take advantage of it. And it was in the introduction to the Chris Trumbo Larry Sepler book. So, but that's, he was constantly so self-aware, and again a humanist. He was a communist, but he was a humanist above all, because he was just always looking out for fairness. He really just believed in fairness and freedom, and he thought it trumped everything, and that was his number.
Well, I would even say, I would say that he wasn't a communist, that he happened to be a member of the American Communist Party, but in truth, I think the more accurate description of him was a socialist, that he loved being rich, but he had tremendous compassion for the working class.
He was a member of the Communist Party, but he was kind of a terrible member. That's why it's true, and that's why we have Louis C.K. busting him for that. Like, well, how can we trust you? You don't act like a communist. You have all this money, and you're so ambitious, and you're about yourself. That's not a collectivist instinct. And so he was, by definition, a member. But even that, he joined in 43, right as we were allied with a communist country, and he quit by 48. And so he was not the ideal communist. He was much more aligned with liberal democratic ideas, and especially about with union. He was very pro workers' rights and very, very anti-fascist. He founded a few groups in L.A. that were anti-fascist groups as well.
And because he was a devout pacifist, he wrote a very famous anti-war novel called Johnny Got His Gun. And that didn't help him. When it came time to point the finger, they said, look, this kind of attitude created the atmosphere for a Hitler to take charge. And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah.
yeah. Okay, right here, down here.
I was just curious as to if there was a conscious decision to make this film outside of the studios, to use a smaller studio system, because maybe they didn't want to perhaps go back into their dirty.
Yeah, just in case people didn't hear, this is sort of independently made. It's released by a company called Bleecker Street. So it's outside of the big studio system. Is that conscious?
That's right. It was shopped around, I think, before I came on with studios. And, you know, at that time, the studios were always pushing for big stars, you know, big, like a Clooney-esque, you know, person, someone to be. But we always wanted, by the time I came on, I wanted it to be an independent film because I wanted the freedom to do what we wanted and to work with people we wanted to work with. Once we thought of Brian, it was like no one was going to talk us into anybody else. It was way too much of a perfect match for the character, and we love what Brian did.
Yeah, I think in truth that if it had been a $25, $30, $40 million movie, they would have demanded a big superstar to play it. And the reality also is that I think the studio stayed away from this. I mean, you look, there's no sex, no fighting, no action at all, and your central character is a communist.
It's not exactly.
Real commercial.
Yeah, and it's not exactly a studio friendly mess. You know, the story, the studios, you know, they weren't exactly the heroes of the story, the heads of the studio. So
is that how you sell the film when you're on Colbert tonight? Yeah.
Wearing the same clothes, by the way.
Yeah, you can watch him at later tonight on the.
We joke about that, but that, think about Kirk Douglas. He put all his own money in Spartacus. He'd fired a director, hired Kubrick, who he didn't get along with. His production company is completely tangled up with the success of that. If that film hadn't worked, his company was over. And he says, I know what we'll do. We'll to guarantee our success, we'll put a communist on the front of the credits. And what the risks he took to do that, and how important that ultimately became for the whole blacklisted system was pretty amazing.
Yeah, and you, Kirk Douglas was somewhat involved. I mean, giving you guys advice, right?
Brian watched it with him.
Yeah, he was. Well, he before all that happened, Jay and the writer John McNamara and our producer Michael London went to his house and he read the script and went over the draft and talked about several different points. Hmm. I don't know how much of ideas or suggestion ended up in there or not, but post-shooting, went over to his house, saw the film. He said some extremely complimentary things about the film, about Jay, about myself, and the rest of the cast, and he said he has one big problem with the movie, and it's like, you know, Spartacus is going to condemn us now. And what is that? He goes, I don't understand why the producers didn't hire me to play Kirk Douglas.
Oh.
And then he did go on and praise Dean O'Gorman's performance. He really liked the way Dean pulled it off. Who, by the way, is Australian. And
wow.
He was barely, you know, I can't even tell what he's talking about most of the time. His accent's so thick.
So thick.
It's so thick.
Okay, we unfortunately have time for one more question, so we'll go right down here.
I was very fascinated by the Michael Stuhlbarg's characters, Edward G. Robinson's characters. I was wondering, this is a question for Brian, if you were to put yourself same situation with actually Michael's characters, what would you do? Because you have to put yourself in, face up in a screen, and at the same time you have to support your family.
Yeah.
What would you do? So
I think just to repeat, in case people didn't hear, you as an actor, if you were in the situation that Edward G. Robinson is,
Well, I what was. As an actor, I was in that position. And I did the noble thing. But as an actor, that's not, it's like, it says it in the script, so that's what I did. You mean, as a person, as you, really Brian.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. oh, hell no. I'm singing. to me, there's really two parts of it. And being a husband and a father myself, that was the shame of this, is that they stripped away the dignity of these men. Not only did they incarcerate them for a year, take away their physical liberties, but took away their dignity and their right to earn a living in their chosen field, and took away their responsibilities to provide for their families. So I get it. It's severe. And even Eddie Robinson went four or five times before the committee and didn't say anything for the first four, and then cracked, basically. Mm. And he had to sign a committee saying how I was duped by the Red, what is it, Red
Some
Menace?
Some kind of a statement, yeah, how he had been
he had to sign, how I was duped by the Red Menace. And on top of everything, embarrassed him, you know. So what would I do? I'd like to think that I, feeling responsible for my family and not wanting to go to jail and put the stress on my family, I don't know that I would have, to be honest with you. I think I might have said, yes, I was a member. I resigned, I quit, and I'm very sorry I made that mistake, and I won't do it again. I think I can find myself, even if I was lying, to say that so that I actually wouldn't go to jail. That would be my honest thought. What I wouldn't do is the follow-up question. And you can't get by with just saying the first answer. Hmm. You say the first answer, and they say, okay, all right, we'll accept that. A folly of the youth, perhaps, your opinion. Okay, we'll get that. Now, who else is, you know, were you with at those meetings? Name the names. We want the names. And if you didn't cooperate on that level, you could go to jail. So I would have to draw the line there. I really searched because I thought about that too, going into playing this, and I just couldn't use that and the abuse of the First Amendment rights to persecute someone else. It's Gestapo tactics. Okay, you're not helping the Jews, then tell me where they are and who else is helping the Jews, or else we're going to put it on you. And it's brutal. It's driven by fear. And I have sympathies for those people who did crack. And as Dalton Trumbo says at the very end in his speech, that he was widely criticized for by going too soft on those who were doing the damage and who named names, as we showed with Eddie, is that there were no winners and no villains in this. Only victims. And he was trying to extend the olive branch to say we're all in pain and we're all wounded by this, but let's move on. We need to now move on from there.
Well, you did an amazing job, both of you, and this film opens tomorrow. Congratulations on it, and thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much. Tell your friends. Tell your friends if James Bond sells out that they should try and go see Trumbo.